The programme you're about to watch is a unique live investigation of the supernatural. It contains material which some viewers may find to be disturbing.
No, I'm not going. I'm not going. Get the link back. Get the link back. Somebody can get the link back.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Nextlander Watchcast, folks. It is the greatest month of the year. And I know you, this is how you know I mean that. My birthday month is the month that comes after this. So if I'm telling you that the month of October is the greatest month of the year, know that there is no personal bias in this.
Hang on, are you one of those month-long birthday people?
No.
Okay.
No, definitely not. But at the same time, you might think that I would associate November as being my favorite month of the year because it is the opportunity to celebrate the birth of me, Alex Navarro, your host. But no, I don't care about that. What I care about, spooky stuff. Mm-hmm. Spooks. Spectres.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. That's what the song says.
It is indeed. Brad Shoemaker, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Vinny Caravella.
I'm here, and I'm going to say I am too much of a kind of head case for this kind of stuff, and it's
define this kind of stuff.
Paranormal, found footage, psychological,
You mean tormenting an entire nation with terror?
Not even just that. Like, is there something in the house? We'll never know. And then I'm like, well, there's definitely something in my house.
Is that the Catholicism talking?
It's probably a lot of stuff. It's probably decades and decades of trauma and guilt and things that, you know, would come back to haunt a person.
I just know that the Catholics have a particular relationship to things like ghosts and possession and things like that.
Oh my gosh, we're right up there. We're like a top five on those.
Yeah, they made a whole movie about it. It's called The Pope's Exorcist. It features Russell Crowe on a Vespa.
We're up there, man. You want horrible hauntings and paying for your sins and devils and demons. Yeah.
You practically invented that shit.
Well, we probably borrowed it and appropriated it from somewhere, but yeah.
There were some pagan beliefs that found their way in there.
Yeah.
Well, folks, it is the Halloween month. I might not celebrate my birthday month, but as far as I'm concerned, the entire month of October is reserved for spooky things, horror things, monster things, what have you, the paranormal.
Oh, paranormal.
Yes. And for this month, we are crossing oceans, not of time, just actual oceans to find
a little bit of time.
A little bit of time, but horror films that were made in countries other than the United States, because as of this recording, while there is movement on the WGA strike front, and it sounds like there is a tentative deal in place, it's not going to be done in time for us to do anything else. So we're sticking with our guns here. We are showing films that were made in other countries, in the horror genre, in the spooky genre, and we are kicking things off with a UK entry in 1992's Ghost Watch.
I had never heard of this before.
Nope. And I didn't even bother to look a thing up about it before I saw, like, absolutely nothing before I sat down to watch it, and within about 30 seconds, I was like, what have you gotten us into?
Well, so, okay, let's talk about early impressions here. I'll give you the basic log line here, which is to say that Ghost Watch was a BBC special that aired on Halloween night in 1992, and it was on broadcast television.
Oh, this was not released theatrically? This is not actually a movie?
No, this was a...
Or it is, I guess it is, it's a feature-length program, but this was never actually, like, presented as a film?
Well, it wasn't. So... The quick, dirty history here is that, again, as I said, it aired on Halloween night and on BBC in 1992. Obviously, the presentation style of this film is very much in the vein of a live special in the way that, like, you know, let's say, like, you know, Geraldo opening up fucking, you know, the vault type stuff.
Yeah,
like,
or,
It's a big special, and they are investigating a haunted house.
Or to put a very fine point on it, it's War of the Worlds, right?
To a degree, yes.
It is a fake TV news broadcast that is presenting itself as a real one. Right?
Yes, and they are including real BBC and just general British television presenters here.
Wow, that's okay. That immediately makes this way crazier and more impressive.
Like, yes.
I think it's been, not to cut to the chase here, it's been so many years of found footage movies.
Yes.
That I just assumed this was a feature presentation movie theatrical thing that was like the first found footage thing or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I did not realize this aired on TV and was presented as an actual news thing. That's crazy.
So there are, if my memory is serving me correctly here, there are a few examples of things that you could definitely call found footage horror that existed prior to this. If I'm remembering correctly, there's one that's called the McPherson tape, which is an extremely low budget thing that is supposed to document a quote unquote alien abduction that's happening. That was, I think, a few years prior to this, though that had very little distribution. I'm not sure anyone really knew about it for the most part until years later. But this, I think you can call one of the first popular, widely viewed examples of something that is like what became the found footage horror genre. In describing this film, they actually call it a mockumentary because I think at the time that was used more to describe things like this, which were fake documentaries and not comedies, which is more like what they are now, like the Christopher Guest style stuff.
Right.
But so this aired on British television. What they ended up doing was the credits you see on this, where they show the written by Stephen Volk, were on the broadcast. But apparently a wide swath of the British audience just did not pay any attention to that when it was broadcast. It was also broadcast in a slot where they normally air TV movies. Like, it was meant to be, it was in the drama section of, you know, like the BBC broadcast schedule. So there were indicating factors that said, no, this is not a real thing. This is a dramatic production. But given the style of presentation, given the way that it aired, and the fact that they are using real TV personalities in this thing, what ended up happening is that a whole bunch of people, specifically because of the way the ending of this thing kind of plays out, freaked the fuck out.
Wow.
Kids in particular apparently had a real rotten time with this thing. When I mentioned we were watching this, some people who were from Britain tweeted at me and stuff and were like, oh man, I remember watching this on Halloween in 1992, scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. And the BBC was so inundated with phone calls that the line started being busy. And given the way this film ends, which is the studio in disarray and fucking Michael Parkinson, like, basically possessed, it added to the furor of feeling like, oh, we can't get through to the BBC. Everything's, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
This really was War of the Worlds. It incited mass panic.
So apparently if you called the BBC the night this aired and you got through, there was a message that immediately said, if you are calling about Ghostwatch, you should know that this is a work of fiction or something to that effect. Like, there was a recorded message there for people, but tons of people couldn't get through, which is what added to the furor of the whole thing.
That's wild.
So you think if we grew up in the UK, we'd probably know what this is?
Yes. And the thing is, if you didn't grow up in the UK, the only way I'm pretty sure you would have found out about this was in the last 10 to 15 years, because they never rebroadcast it on UK television after this.
Was it produced live?
No.
Or pre-recorded?
It was pre-recorded.
Sure. Okay, because this seems a little too elaborate to pull off live.
Yeah, so they shot it in the style of a live special, but all the stuff that was shot at the house was done in July. And then a month later, they filmed all the live studio stuff. And the live studio stuff, they were essentially like cutting together footage from the previous shoot in there to show to Parkinson and the people in the studio live, like they were responding to it. Like, there was a script, obviously, they knew what the lines were going to be and all that kind of stuff. But there was also a degree of improvisation, because you have news personalities here. You have talk show personalities,
right?
Not necessarily actors. Sarah Green, who is the one that's in the field, does have some acting training. But like Michael Parkinson, he's not an actor. Like, he's a presenter. He's a news personality and journalist and interviewer. So a lot of his dialogue was him kind of going off the cuff in the moment.
That's amazing. Like, I wanted to come in here and basically say, like, my favorite quote-unquote character in this is the crusty old British TV presenter archetype.
Oh, Parky.
Finding out that he is actually a famous crusty old TV presenter is incredible. Like, I'm kind of glad I didn't know about any of this going in.
Yeah.
Like, it's way crazier to find out about it after the fact, because, like, you know, I kind of couldn't shake the community theater vibe of it for the first half.
Totally.
Like, it does actually kind of improbably get its hooks in you, or at least it did for me.
Yeah.
To the point that I was like, all right, this is actually kind of creepy toward the end, but, you know, like, definitely for the first part of it, there's, like, a whole lot of, like, very earnest capital A acting stuff going on.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, I kind of knew the setup for this, because I think, Alex, you had mentioned it, that this was had that vibe. And when I was watching, I was like, oh, I've seen enough BBC, even early BBC stuff, to be like, BBC shit could be corny as hell. Like, this,
oh, yeah.
this probably fit right in with the stuff at the house and the branding on Ghostwatch. And, like, man, this probably fit right in at the time of, like, this could be believable. Because I was in the same boat, Brad, with my wife. If you come to it with decades of found footage experience, mm-hmm. this looks so corny
oh, yeah.
as hell.
It's very stagey compared to some of the other stuff.
But if you come to it with, like, oh, this is just another night on the BBC because all their stuff is corny as hell and we've all watched Doctor Who and that shit's corny as hell too.
Wow, you're really going in on the British entertainment industry here, aren't you?
Look, as a fan of Doctor Who, I think everybody can admit that it's pretty corny.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, you know, like, their presentation has been cheese on some stuff.
Oh, yeah. And, well, so the thing is, Ghostwatch, even though it is not technically part of a franchise or anything, there were other shows that aired around this time that were called, like, Hospital Watch and Crime Watch that were, like, I think they were sort of in the vein of, like, Rescue 911 style, like, dramatization
gotcha.
Type things, but there was also, like, a little bit of, like, live reporting happening. I've never seen any of those shows, but they mentioned them when talking about this stuff. So Ghostwatch was sort of meant to kind of fit into the same bucket as, like, those kinds of shows. So, like, when you're watching it, you kind of have that in the back of your mind of, like, oh, it's going to be that kind of show, whatever.
And I'll just add this, not to say that the BBC corners the market on cheese. If this were on CNN with, like, Anderson Cooper doing a thing, it would
right.
be corny as hell. They'd have a hologram going into the house with a big giant screen with everybody. You know, it would
yeah.
also be...
If Wolf Blitzer was there with his fucking telestrator, you know, it's like, okay,
yeah.
so we're up here
yeah.
in the bedroom right now, and in the back corner, we see what looks like might be a shadow.
I think my eyes are bleeding. I think back to you in the studio. Yeah. Like, anybody who's watched election night coverage knows what a goddamn overproduction all of those things are.
Oh, man, if they get the guy with the numbers, if they get this number-crunching dude on there fucking talking about, like, okay, so you got a 55% chance that this is actually haunted.
Man, I would watch a horror movie starring Steve Kornacki any day.
Totally.
Steve Kornacki at the big board, are we haunted? Let me run the numbers here.
So let's talk a little bit here more about the production here before, because, I mean, look, as much as there is a plot to talk about, I think that's a little less the draw than it is sort of like kind of the spectacle around this thing. So as I mentioned, you know, our presenters here are real life TV presenters. Sir Michael Parkinson was a very well regarded and certainly, you know, well known face and voice in British broadcasting. He hosted his own show at various points. He regularly appeared on BBC, ITV, a bunch of other places. And Sarah Green and Mike Smith, who are both real-life married, or were married until Mike Smith's death in 2014, were both also British TV presenters of some you know regard. So people knew who these people were.
Quick point. Michael Parkinson passed away last month.
Yes, he did.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
August 16th, 2023.
I think he mostly retired back in like 2007. But he was, yeah, I mean, he was in the British TV industry for something like 40, 50 years.
Hmm.
And then Craig Charles is the other real-life personality here. He's the sort of chucklehead comedian on the street guy who goes around interviewing people. He is a real-life comedian, an actor. He was on stuff like Red Dwarf and Coronation Street. You know, he's another staple of some British TV comedy. And then Leslie Manning is our director. She was mostly a television and short film director. And Stephen Volk is the screenwriter. Who also wrote a few notable horror films, including Gothic and The Guardian, which is one of the first horror movies I ever saw at a birthday party. It's not very good, but that's not the point. It's some late William Friedkin. Not so good. And so this thing was always pitched very much as, well, we're going to do a dramatic presentation. It's going to be a dramatic show. And it was originally pitched as a six-part miniseries. Mm. It was going to be building up to the thing that we saw, which is to say the live special. The previous episodes would be a bunch of history of the haunting and the location, more on the ground reporting type stuff involving the family. And then they would be building up to this live special and the last night. And the BBC said, yeah, we're not going to invest in a 6-hour supernatural thing. That's not really what we're looking for. But we have an open slot on Halloween if you want to do a special. And so what they ended up doing was they rewrote the script for the finale to include more of the history of the haunting, inserting things like the phone calls that come in that sort of explain some of the history around the location to kind of give that backstory while the live special is happening. And okay. So what you end up with is this thing that is, I'm going to say, a little clumsy in its delivery at times, because it does kind of have to jam in these little bits of backstory and history and all that stuff in kind of weird locations. But beyond that, I feel like is actually pretty expertly paced at misdirecting the audience in terms of feeling like, what is it I'm actually seeing here? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The way it takes so long to wind up to anything really happening, and then also throwing the red herring of the daughter, like, either through possession or through whatever else, faking some of the things that they are experiencing, it does a pretty good job making you feel like, oh, we've just watched Al Capone's vault being opened.
It's good at recovering repeatedly. Yes.
I think in the context also of a non-starter of a live event that might go nowhere, in the context of it being live, it feels like that. Like, oh, this is a nothing. Nothing's going to happen here until it kind of escalates and goes pretty far. Like,
yeah,
for public TV and broadcast, it gets fairly, fairly dark.
Yes. And that's the thing that really, I think, set a lot of things off, is that the BBC as a public entity is one of the most fascinating things in the world to me as far as entertainment goes, because it's a publicly funded network that actually does cool shit, things that I like. As much as I like, as much as I regard PBS well and want it to survive and exist, let's be real, the number of things I watch on PBS is nearly zero.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the BBC is like the main network in the UK, and, you know, it is publicly funded. It is, and it's also supposed to be an authority. You know, like the way that the BBC was treated, especially at this time, was if you are watching something on the BBC, if you're experiencing something on the BBC, it's because either they are clearly marketing it as drama and entertainment, or it is news, or it is reality to some degree. And one of the big sticking points, I think, for a lot of people who complained about this after the fact is the idea that they were tricked by an entity like the BBC, which is supposed to be an authority and not supposed to mess with you.
Yeah. Were they? I don't know. I mean, like you said, there's titles right at the top of this thing that make it very clearly a work of fiction.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're just flipping channels and come in midway,
yes,
and you see all these personalities from TV that you already know doing the things they do. I mean, I guess I could see it.
Yeah, and you're watching, like, a dude get a head injury in the middle of, you know, a weird haunted situation and a girl talking through weird voice. Like, the idea of a demonic possession being shown in any kind of, like, cinema verite slash reality context is really, I could see that fucking someone up.
I forgot about the head injury. That actually did feel like a significant escalation.
Yeah.
But there's also, like, the scratches on the little girl's face.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the description of the history of the house was, you know, it's just verbal, but still, like, pretty dark.
Yeah.
Cats eating the person.
Yeah, eating his face off.
The dog in the park was gross. Like, the dog that they were vivisecting or cutting open and, was like pregnant, was like, you're going really far with this whole dog thing.
Also, I'm sure I could look up like how many sightings of the ghost there actually are in this. I don't know if I caught all of them, but a couple of those are like kind of genuinely creepy.
Yeah. The first time I caught like a real glimpse of it that wasn't just that black curtain thing that they kind of show you at the beginning, and they show two versions of that shot, one where you can kind of make out a figure and one where you can't. Like, the first time you see it in the window, I feel like was the first time I was like, oh, okay. All right, we're on to something here. Yeah. We're going.
The one that got me was the playground.
Oh, I didn't even see that one.
Oh my God, that's the worst one to me. That, go back and when they're in the playground talking about the dog, finding the dead dog and all that stuff, and then when they walk off, there's just like a crowd of people gathered around watching them film.
Yeah.
The ghost is standing there right in the background, like in the back of the huddle of people.
I don't think I saw that one either.
And it's like And it's like pretty visible how the kind of grisly face wounds and stuff.
Oh, I see him. I see him. Holy shit.
Yeah. It's that
it's
one.
It's such
that
a quick glimpse.
That one actually got me pretty good.
Yeah.
Because you can see all the blood around the eyes and everything. It's like kind of super creepy.
Yeah.
There's the Spectre one when they're in the studio, right? And they're doing the, he's talking to her and like they dim all the lights and you could see him hovering.
He's standing up by
her.
One of the lights that explodes also, yes.
Oh, at the end.
There's one at the end where he's standing up by the lights at the top where they're like, they're popping off.
Interesting. I didn't catch any of him in the studio.
There's one in the very beginning after they do the thing with the people calling in, seeing him, where they go over, because they do a bunch of her previous research stuff. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, let's go over and do a thing. And they dim all the lights. And it's like before they start going through the cupboards of all the broken pottery
yeah.
in the studio. That's cool. Like, that stuff's neat. It's, some of it comes off as corny, but some of it works. And I think as you go more and more into it, you realize they're really committed to this.
Yeah. We'll talk about the aftermath, I think, toward the end of this as we kind of go through the actual film. But, like, as I said, this was part of what I think they call the Screen One drama banner is what they, well, I guess this kind of, these TV movie type things were sort of presented under. So, like you said, they were going out of their way to a certain degree to try and hint to the audience that it was not real while not just completely undermining the effect of what they were trying to do, which is to say, create something that still could be scary. So I think they were kind of caught off guard by the way people responded to this thing. And the BBC brass in particular was because as I mentioned, the title card at the beginning where they show the writer written by was added at the very last minute, like literally the day before broadcast, because someone at BBC got slightly cold feet about it. But apparently prior to that, they'd been sitting through meetings and the producer of the thing had been like, hey, so I'm working on this thing. I want to make sure we're cool with what we're doing here. And every time he brought it up, they were just like, yeah, it's fine. We know what you do over there. Don't worry about it. Like it was not presented as a big deal. And then after the fact, they got 30,000 phone calls about it. And tabloids went nuts over it and just were like, savaging the BBC for like, tricking the public and giving people, like terrifying them in this way because it just, again, they felt like the public trust had been breached in some way. And, after watching kind of the behind the scenes documentary, most of the filmmakers are like, we were always making a production. This was always meant to be a production, and we went through as many steps as we could without just straight up screaming to the audience, this is fake.
Yeah.
And I feel like they did what they were supposed to do. Now, granted, I'm a carny at heart. I do watch wrestling, after all. I'm all for a good spook show and a thing that can kind of, at least trick me a little bit or make me think that, like, oh, well, what if this could be real? But I can also kind of understand how if you've got kids and you're watching this thing on BBC One and there's this presentation of, like, hey, by the way, the ghost might be in your fucking house right now.
Yeah.
That's not a fun thing to have to talk your kid through, if nothing else. Yeah,
like, I mean, the shot of the little girl with scratches all over her face is like kind of, I don't know if graphic is quite the word I would use, but it's like not pleasant for a child to see.
No. No, there's scratch marks all over, and, the way she's behaving is very much like a don't touch me kind of thing, and that's even before she starts going into the demon voice.
Susie. Stop it! Stop it, Susie!
Which is actually the director, apparently, because she tried to get a voice actor in there to do the voice that she had come up with, and they couldn't do it. She's like, oh, I'll just do it.
What are you talking about? No person could actually emulate this voice.
It's true. It's impossible.
I learned about, speaking of kids watching it, a thing, the watershed, the 9 p.m. watershed, which I had never heard of before, which I guess is a thing where after the 9 p.m. watershed is when you can show the saucy TV in the UK.
And apparently the problem was it was too soon after the 9 p.m. watershed for something that terrifying.
I just like the term. I always like the term watershed, and I like it applied to something when the kids have to be in bed. It sounds very like dystopian future. It's the watershed.
There's a lot of fun British-specific terminology for things that get wrapped in here, as well as some terminology that I'm going to say is less British and more just confusing, like calling that part of your house the glory hole.
My husband, my ex-husband,
used to develop his own photos in a dark room under the stairs. The glory holes, we used to call it when I was a kid.
Don't go in the glory hole.
Just, you know, I was just going to let that one sail on by.
There's no glory to be had in that hole.
You looked in the glory hole and you saw pipes.
and something looked back.
My wife and I shot each other a look immediately.
They keep saying it, is the thing. They don't stop.
I was just like, all right, cultural differences.
So so you guys knew nothing about this going into the film.
I knew what I had told you. Yeah, yeah, what you had told me, right?
Yeah, so going into this, you know, we talked a little bit about kind of its influence on found footage horror, but I would like to know what your guys' level of experience with that genre in particular is, because I've seen a lot of Paranormal's Activity and Blair's Witch and various other things, which are very clearly inspired by this. But I don't know what you got, like how much of that stuff you guys have consumed.
I saw first Blair Witch in the theater. I think I saw the first Paranormal Activity, but just that one. I thought that one was pretty good. And
that first one is still very good, I think. Yeah.
Like the whole thing with the wife standing next to the bed for hours still kind of gets to me.
Some genuinely creepy imagery.
Is Insidious found footage? It's not.
No. That's, if I remember correctly, Insidious is more the loosely based on... Or am I thinking... No, it is Insidious. It's the one that's based, I think, on the psychic couple that does all the ghost hunting stuff, the Warrens.
Sorry, I feel like there's like one other found footage horror movie I have seen that is well known that I can't think of. I've also seen like Chronicle, which is not horror, but is found footage.
Yeah. I mean, found footage had a real moment through the 2000s and kind of into the teens. There was a lot of those movies being made fairly, because they're fairly cheap to make, is the thing. Yeah.
Like Cloverfield was hugely hyped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in more recent times, there's stuff like Host, which is a film that is done entirely over video chat. There's definitely been some branching out of that genre into more modern technology and finding ways to play with that. And I haven't seen Host, but I've heard really good things about it. It seems like people have found ways to make that found footage stuff more interesting as time has gone along. But this movie and this production in particular really is cited as a direct influence on a lot of what came after it, including the Blair Witch Project. If you listen, hear the filmmakers talk about it, they don't think the Blair Witch Project would have existed if not for what they did.
Really?
I don't know if I could say that is 100% accurate, but I you can see the threads of this extending out into other things. And, you know, with the Blair Witch Project, I don't know if you remember this, Brad, or when you went to see it, but when I went to see it, there was definitely a little bit of, like, urban legend shit around it of, like, oh, this really happened.
There absolutely, like, it was widespread of people going, like, when,
yeah,
either asking, is this real? Like, what the hell? And a lot of people just thought it was.
Yeah. And I remember I went to a midnight screening of it the night before it actually came out, and I remember, like, at that point, look, I had the inkling that, yes, of course, they're not putting a real-life snuff film out in theaters, but it's so effective at what it does with its extremely limited tool set that it really did disquiet me in a way that I feel like a lot of other horror from that era was not doing.
Yeah, but also, like, I mean, A, Blair Witch is very well put together and effective for what it's trying to do, but also, like, if people especially are, like, younger and are looking back and going, like, come on, how fucking gullible were you? At the time, like, there was just so much less information available, and, like, society was just especially, like, in terms of, like, media literacy and cultural awareness, like, just so much more naive and innocent, I guess I would say. Like, information didn't propagate the way it does now, you know? Like, most people were not getting, you know, like, you weren't just going on Facebook or Twitter and seeing people talk about how this thing was made or, like, you know, what the actual background of it was or whatever. Like, it was a lot easier in the absence of any kind of real tangible information to go in thinking it was real.
Totally. And now you step back another 6 or 7 years where, you know, internet in general is just not consumer grade at all. The only way you can really talk to people about stuff is either at the water cooler or over the phone. And the only way you can find out what you just watched was fake was to get in touch with the BBC and be like, what the fuck did I just see? And some people couldn't even do that. You can actually, I think you can understand how even something as stagey feeling as this now could have totally rocked a bunch of people that just tuned in unawares, uncertain of what it was they were actually watching.
Just to add again, the level of not expecting everything to be lying to you constantly.
Sure. That's actually, yes, that's kind of what I was trying to think of a way to get at.
Like the cynicism.
Yes.
Like
just cynicism, irony, self-awareness, like meta stuff, you know, like the idea of like meta narrative type stuff kind of didn't exist to most people.
Yeah, it was out there, but you had to kind of look for it, whereas this was just straight up broadcast on the BBC and primetime television. So, you know, again, I understand how this sort of happened. I kind of wish, and this is maybe the first time I've ever said this in my life, kind of wish I could have grown up in the UK and had that experience, you know? I know it was maybe traumatic for some kids, but the idea of having something like that you can look back on and be like, oh man, they really got us when we were, you know, when we were kids. Like, you just don't get shit like that on US broadcasts. Like, it's just, I just don't think it's possible, especially nowadays.
You don't get the fun kind of lying.
Exactly. No, it's all the miserable kind.
It's all the bad lying. Yeah.
Well, I think before we kind of get into the meat of the actual production, we should just take our break now. I don't think this is going to be a super long watch cast because the amount of plot here is not that high. So we're just going to take our break now. We will be right back. And we are back, and it is time to actually talk about what happens in Ghostwatch. So the setup for this is pretty innocent, pretty by the numbers. You have your TV presenters, you have your BBC One studio, Michael Parkinson in his comfy chair with his ghost portrait behind him in fake fireplace.
And their very dated-looking video wall.
Yeah, it's, I mean, by 1992, that was probably some fucking high-grade shit. But, sure. You know, when they brought that, wheeled that telestrator out that looked like you could fucking clobber a man's skull with, you know, it's pretty heavy technology. But, yeah, nowadays it's pretty dated.
Look, I'm surprised the telestrator even worked. That's some pretty good tech there.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been...
Use your light pen.
I feel like John Madden telestrator had been around for a little bit at this point, but was not widely used. So this still would have been fairly novel. You have Mike Smith also in the booth, talking to the various telephone operators, taking your calls throughout the night.
Right, this part of the studio is your part of the studio this evening because this is the phone number we'd like you to call us on. You can now see our Ghostwatch team are here, ready to take your calls. We particularly want to hear from you if you've had any personal experiences of ghosts or the supernatural. Call us now.
As a matter of fact, of course, Mike Smith has a very particular reason for keeping a beady eye on the proceedings tonight. Michael?
Well, so would you if your wife had just told you she was going to spend the best part of a night in the most haunted house in Britain.
Of course, we're talking about Sarah Green, and Sarah is our reporter who'll be spending the night actually inside our haunted house. She's very keen to do it, I understand, Mike.
Oh, yeah, jumped at the chance. Actually, so did I, because we've both been interested in ghosts and that weird sort of stuff. And to be honest, I could never have sat at home tonight on my own and watched this program. I'm safer here.
And then we have Sarah Green on site was it Foxwood Drive?
Yes, I think that's
Fox
right.
Hill?
Fox Hill Drive,
I think.
They are at a council house, which is public housing, I believe, in the UK, where a family, a single mother and her two daughters, are being tormented by some kind of unseen force. They have described things like scratches, many different objects being broken around the house, water functioning and then non-functioning and giving off a putrid smell when it does work. That could just be council housing, but you never know. And... you know, generally just being terrified for their lives in this public house that, you know, for one reason or another, they can't leave.
So, how destructive has the haunting actually been?
He kept on blaming us for breaking stuff. We weren't doing anything.
Oh, I've lost track, really. I have plates, teapots, cups, a broken tap. We got this thick smell, so disgusting, from the tap. Stains got on clothes from nowhere, out of thin air.
And then the central heating went.
Yeah, the man came and, well, he couldn't understand it. He said it was impossible. Everybody said it was impossible. I said, great, you come and live with impossible. So many things have happened. You start thinking, I don't know, maybe you've done something wrong. It's wrecked my house, my home, my family.
It's okay. Over to you, Michael.
So Sarah Green is on site. She is going to be spending the night there. They have their chucklehead man on the street talking to the neighbors and other people, including a psychological... What is it? What do they call us? The fucking the paranormal researcher guy?
Yeah. Oh, God.
The one on the street?
Yeah. The guy that shows up at the beginning and then kind of doesn't really show up again until the very end. The guy with the beard and the ponytail.
Yeah.
Now, before we go into the lion's den, I'd like to introduce you to Alan Dumescu. He is an electronics engineer and a member of the Society for Psychical Research.
I've mentioned this before. I watch ghost shows because I find them entertaining, not because I am a firm believer in the paranormal, though I like to allow for a little bit of possibility for wonder in this world, what little there is. Mm. I find them entertaining because I love watching people try to stretch turn in actual television out of standing in an abandoned room and hearing clunks, you know, like weird static and clunks, and turning that into vivid television. Most shows are not that interesting. I find Ghost Adventures kind of fun because those guys are huge fucking dorks, Hot Topic dorks that somehow were granted many wishes by God and became TV celebrities. But they do this sort of thing every Halloween. They do a big Halloween special where they will go in to some profoundly haunted location and do like a 2-hour quote-unquote live special where they are, you know, gathering evidence from this kind of thing. I don't think there was a lot of this sort of thing on TV in 1992. I don't think they did this kind of stuff very much with paranormal stuff on TV broadcasts back then, because I don't ever remember seeing much of anything like this. And I watch this kind of TV somewhat religiously now. And so this presentation, while kind of old hat and kind of the sort of thing you just see on like basic reality TV now all the time, what they're talking about here with their infrared cameras and, you know, they're looking for cold spots and stuff, these are now staples of what you consider ghost hunting TV.
Mm.
And I think they said straight up the infrared camera was new, like as of the Gulf War new.
Huh, sure. Yeah, they're pretty kitted out in this. You know, they've got like cameras in literally every room, every angle of the house.
Look, Predator came out in what, 87?
Yes. Yeah. But they were not using those cameras in the field on a general in a general basis back then.
The infrared camera is the whole thing. They're very ready to go here.
I think they called the ones that are sort of like up around the hallways and stuff around the house SIG cameras, like because I think they're shaped like cigarettes.
I don't know if I caught that.
I think that was in the behind the scenes thing that I watched. Oh, they were describing some of the stuff they were using. But, you know, they're setting this up like a real ghost hunt, which anyone nowadays could very easily recognize, but back then probably felt kind of wild to be watching and seeing what kind of tech they were using. And the story here is, you know, very much, again, this family has been tormented by this thing, but they kind of get into sort of, like, the history of the place. There's a parapsychologist who is in the studio with Michael Parkinson talking through her investigations of this place, the ways that she has sort of, like, delved into the phenomena. I'm going to say this stuff straight up feels like Peter Venkman shit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like showing the girl different cards, being like, okay, what do you see?
More a little Ghostbusters 2 Peter Venkman.
Yes, he's got TV the Peter Venkman.
Yeah, 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 TV Peter Venkman. And, you know, he touches his head, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have a good day. Yeah, right. They have the counter, the man of science from New York, who doesn't come back, right?
They have him on once. Twice. I think he's on
twice.
But
not
twice
after
total.
It all pops off. No. I wanted to see, yeah.
The guy is doing a pretty pointed Jeff Goldblum impression to me, if you listen to his delivery.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. There's nothing in the tape that couldn't be faked. The bedroom footage is totally inconclusive. It could all be done with wires for all we know.
And the lesions on Suzanne's face?
Scratched by her fingernails.
She's not lying. Believe her.
I'd love to. Same as I'd love to believe I'm going to heaven, but it doesn't make it a scientific fact.
But if people do believe in something, surely we shouldn't discount it. I mean, it's all part of human experience, and that's what we're studying.
Fine, but is it measurable? Is it provable? No. For years, parapsychologists have been trying to prove their loony theories in laboratory conditions, and they can't.
Yeah, that's right. We can't. That's where we went wrong. There are some things you can't demonstrate in a lab. Show me falling in love in a lab. Show me poetic inspiration in a lab. You can't. You've got to get out of the lab and into real life, and that's what we're trying to do tonight. These people are not deceiving us or themselves. Look at them. They're in trauma, for God's sake. Why would they do it to themselves? The early family are suffering just like people who've had murder bereavements or plane crashes. The only difference is that nobody says that they don't believe in plane crashes.
But most of us don't believe that people come back from them.
So this is Colin Stinton. He is a character actor from the UK originally, but moved to the United States pretty early in his life. So that's why the American accent. But he's one of those character actors that moves between America and the UK interchangeably because he just does. But yes, yeah. He has this very minor role as this this skeptic from New York. And he's a real shitheel. I'm going to say, as much as, you know, I understand a skeptic has to be a little bit of one when presented with something like this. He definitely has this feel of like, well, you know, I'd say yeah. I told you so if this weren't so tragic.
Or like a lot of science in air quotes when talking about the research being done. But they also, the thing that you mentioning that this could have been part of a longer series, they try to fill in a lot of backstory of the parapsychologists going around and following this family for months, if yes. not years, right? Books and here's other footage of them on talk shows and them trying to make their case that led up to this embedded reporter spending the night on Halloween.
Yes, exactly. That is what was supposed to be the original buildup.
Yeah. So like we just see the embedded reporter stuff and they kind of backfill throughout the course of the thing, which for better or worse, I mean, they're stretching, they're filling in. So I don't think I needed it. I don't think I needed this kind of justification for it. But they say, finally, they're tired of being mocked and nobody believes them. And these tabloid newspaper articles about them. And finally, it's time to just have somebody spend the night.
So it's worth noting that the story of this production, like the ghost story that they are sort of basing everything around, is very loosely based on a real life, fairly famous UK haunting. And by real life, I mean it is a story. You know, that no actual allusions as to whether there was really a poltergeist or not. But
who's to say?
It was referred to as the Enfield poltergeist, which was also in a council house, I believe, somewhere in Greater London. And speaking of the Warrens and all the things involving, and I think actually Insidious is not the Warrens, but the Conjuring movies are, and the Conjuring 2 is also directly based on the Enfield poltergeist and the Warrens investigation of it. The Warrens, if you don't know them, Elaine Warren, it purports to be a psychic. Her husband, Ed, is a parapsychologist and researcher. They are by large, considered to be quacks. But you know, they are one of those people that like they've sunk their tendrils so deep into the concept of paranormal and parapsychological that anyone who does that sort of thing reveres them, whether they should or not. But they are about as famous a figure in that scene as you can get.
I have heard from multiple people that The Conjuring is like a level above terrifying.
Oh, yeah. The Conjuring movies are actually very well made. Whatever I think of the Warrens as fiction, it's really well delivered.
Like people I know who just like eat horror movies for breakfast and don't care have told me that they came away from The Conjuring like pretty messed up for a while.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know so much about The Conjuring 2, but The Conjuring 1 was very well done. So I just mentioned that because, you know, while they are not taking the direct story of the Enfield poltergeist, that is the thing they are basing this on. The idea of a family tormented in this council house by some larger force. And the family itself, you know, it's the mother, it's the two daughters. They've been affected in different ways. And the mother, you know, I'm going to say Brid Brennan, who plays Pamela Early, the mother, very good at portraying a woman at the end of her rope.
Yeah.
And I'm going to also give a shout out to Gillian Beavan as Dr. Lynn Pascoe, the parapsychologist. She's very convincing.
Yeah.
So much so that she was a recognizable actress back then. Mm. Like, she was on TV and stuff. She had been doing work at that point. So it is conceivable that someone would have seen her in this and been like, okay, well, this is fake. Apparently not enough, because she was convincing enough that people thought it was real.
Yeah, they're all pretty good. I mean, as it goes on, I think it gets better because as some of the or at least you become more accustomed to the vibe, but some of the pretense it falls away.
It's a pretty slow start. Yeah. Like, there's a lot of build. There's a lot of like, I don't even know how long it is before the first like crazy thing happens. half an hour or something.
I want to say the first time you catch an actual glimpse of the thing in a reflection somewhere is like around the 40, 50 minute mark or something.
Okay.
There's noises and a few other things that are alluded to, but that's it.
Okay. The first thing I remember is there's a shot of the bedroom, I think, from the like night that got recorded of the little girls being terrified. And
that's the very first thing, yes.
And that's where they like back up the tape, yeah. And then you see the silhouette of the guy behind the curtain, but then when they replay it, he's not there anymore type stuff.
And that's them kind of just sort of playing with you and being like, hey, you know, what you see, you might not get an acknowledgement of until, you know, it's too late. And then, you know, later on when the phone calls start coming in, everyone's like, no, I saw that fucking thing in the tape. Can you go back to the tape? Show the thing in the tape. The thing you don't get, which I was waiting for, was the hey, I saw that thing in the reflection. I saw that thing in the window. Yeah. I saw it in Brad, in your case, you saw it standing there in the crowd.
I did not see the one you're talking about, the reflection.
So it's when they find the trail of children's drawings that lead up to the sliding glass door, and then the cat is there.
Oh, maybe I actually did see that now that you mention it.
So the camera pans back up once they see the cat, and when they pan it back up, the ghost is standing right next to the sound guy. But it's such a quick glimpse that you're not sure if you're just seeing one of the camera people or if it's the ghost.
And the one I was talking about, I think, is if you're watching it, it's around the 29 minute mark. It's in the background when they're playing that reel to reel at about the 30 minute mark, and he's just standing over her left shoulder.
I think I might have seen that one too.
That was the first one that I was like, oh, okay, here's what we're doing.
Okay,
this is good. I like this. We're gonna subtly insert this apparition into the back.
Oh yes. I remember seeing that one was just vague enough that it was like, is that crew?
Right.
Is that just like a crew member back there catching the light or something?
And now we're in like the three men and a little baby poster with the ghost, or the three men and a little baby with the ghost in the background. Do you remember that whole thing? And like, just kind of hunt around for it, which was fun because the whole time you're hunting around for this apparition.
Yeah.
The mom and the daughters, they vaguely get into her backstory with the husband, and they do more with the glory hole and his photography or whatever was going on down there.
Yeah, they mostly just mention that she's divorced, and they don't really get too much into it beyond that.
Or they use it as some kind of flimsy excuse to be like, well, the daughter's from this broken home, and like, you know, maybe she's
acting out, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is I think the reason this thing is still successful, not just as a, you know, sort of a precursor to a broader genre, but like as an actual work unto itself, I think the only reason this thing really comes together at the end is because they do spend so much time misdirecting you and making you think that what you're watching is in fact a hoax on purpose, you know?
They do. He does a great job. He does a good turn at some point with her, with the host, when the phone calls are still coming in, and he's like, "Okay, all right, let's hang up. This is ridiculous.
Let's be real. We've seen what we've seen."
Yeah,
here.
Yeah. Come on, let's be. And he does a great job of taking the viewer along with him to be like, "Oh, we're done. Like we're done here. This is a hoax." And like, and he's basically to everyone else like, "All right, give it up. We're done."
Well, that's quite extraordinary. We set out to catch a ghost, and sadly, very sadly, what we witnessed was a remarkable exposure of a hoax.
Let's not be too hasty.
Oh, come on, Doctor, please. We surely got to accept.
No,
we saw
I don't.
It there.
Look, this is an established pattern. Genuine phenomena followed by the fakery stage when the children feel obliged to come up with the goods.
Doctor, really?
I'm sorry, because...
Well, I mean, after 8 months of commitment and committed work like you've been through, I can understand that you feel upset because you've been duped.
I'd be the first to admit it if I was absolutely sure I had been duped.
Oh, Doctor, really?
Oh, please don't be simplistic. This is one incident amongst many, many dozens. I was there. I've seen them. I've seen inexplicable things. 100%. No question.
And this?
Let's not get sidetracked, please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That might have been the first point in this that I realized it was actually kind of working on me, was that when they catch the little girl making the noises and he's just like, well, this is a hoax. This is.
Yeah.
I actually felt a sense of secondhand embarrassment for the lady.
Yeah.
You know, like I felt that feeling of like, oh no, this is rough. Like, you know what I mean?
This is all going wrong. Yeah.
Yes. Like that kind of like feeling bad for somebody who is kind of getting shown up or whatever. Like I was like, obviously this is not real, but I still felt bad for the lady for like kind of getting put on the spot.
But even before that, like even before it actually really takes that turn, I think a lot of what they do is really good setup. Like you know, they have the fucking chucklehead man on the street reporter who sucks. And his whole thing is that he's just taking this as not seriously as possible. And so he gets into this thing where he's like talking to the neighbors, and the neighbor's like, oh no, no, dude, seriously, some fucked up shit happened in that house. Like, yeah, you shouldn't really be talking about this.
The neighbor kind of takes him to task, actually.
Yeah.
Bill! I bet that scared you, didn't it? No, this is not a mask. This is Craig Charles live, you lucky people. And here we have the thrill seekers, pillars of the community, all waiting to see if the ghost is going to arrive. Welcome to Fright Night. Now, I'm going to give you a little guided tour of the community, and we're going to meet some people who are pretty upset about some weird goings-on, and we're going to go to a pretty sinister place. Let's break into a little bit of a jog length. Gets me fit, this jog. I tell you what, Michael, I hate Halloween. I hate apples, I hate duck apples. I hate little kids all dressed up in like the devil. And I'm going to meet this woman, Yvonne Etherly, and she's on this piece of waste ground here, I think. And she's going to tell us some pretty peculiar things. Yvonne Etherly. Yvonne? Which one? You're Yvonne. Okay. Yvonne, can you tell me about some of the things that have been going on around here?
Well, we live opposite Pam at number 43, and one night, ages ago now, we heard all this banging. So we went to the front door, and it was obvious it was coming from Pam's house.
So what did you see?
Well, the top window was smashed, and Pam and Kimmy were in the garden crying, so we made them a cup of tea, and they just come into us whenever they need to, basically.
It all sounds a little bit weird. What's it like living in England's answer to Amityville?
Well, it's no joke. I mean, it's not very funny. I mean, some really weird and horrible things happen around here.
What kind of weird things?
Well, there was that wee girl that went missing. What was
Judy Welland.
Judy Welland. It was in all the papers.
What happened to her?
Nobody knows. I mean, she just disappeared. And then, well, I know you're always reading about people that were knifed and all that sort of thing, but somebody was knifed around here that was 5 years old.
5 years old?
Like, that stuff is really good. I think Parkinson's delivery prior to that, where he's kind of along for the ride and just goofing, but like not in a way that's like, this is ridiculous and beneath me, but more of like, yeah, let's go hang out at a haunted house for a night. Let's see what happens. You know, yeah, let's just have a nice night here around the fire with my stupid ghost portrait behind me. And let's just see how this goes, because why not? I think that energy is actually goes a long way to making you feel like you are watching a live television special with a real news guy who is presenting this as if, like, okay, even if I don't believe this is real, I think this could be a fun time. This could be a good way to spend a Halloween night. And all that stuff goes a long way to making you feel like you're watching something that could be a TV special, even though you know it's fiction.
I think for me, also, sure, like, just how far they were willing to go kept me riveted, because they pushed further than I think I would have expected.
Yeah. Because for a long time, basically nothing happens.
Yeah.
You know, there's the footage that they roll back a few times. They show some archive footage of the parapsychologist working with the daughters, the photos, you know, of like the scratches and things like that.
There's a wet but spot mostly, on the carpet.
The wet. Well, that's when things turn. Yeah. Is I think when the wet spot on the carpet happens, that's when things start to turn. That's when things, they start to get toward the hoax and then not hoax part.
Yeah, I mean, your big lead-in is this footage of the little girls in the bedroom, and that is in literally the first 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Although at that point, I was coming to grips with like the tone and nature of this whole thing in general, and also like as piercing as their screams are, and as much as I was like, man, do I need to turn this down in this apartment building? Like, are people going to wonder what the fuck we're doing down here? But also, that's definitely one of the more community theater kind of moments to me of like, they told these little girls like, hey, yeah, act as scared as you can, like scream as loud as you.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like that, I guess that's supposed to be your big, like, oh man, serious shit's going down here moments, but it comes off a little stilted. And then, like you said, it's a long time after that before anything else crazy happens.
But I think that's how you lull the audience. You know, that's how you get the mark to go along with what you're doing. And as much as they say, this was always intended to be drama and we don't want to fool people, the only way this story is effective is if you at least are willing to go along with it and, you know, at least allow the possibility that, whoa, well, what if this was real, you know? And I think that it's actually genuinely incredibly effective at that in that context. Even now, as like going back and watching it so many years later, you know, it's good enough at what it does. And it's especially toward the end, it's a pretty spooky little thing. But I could, to me, this feels like this is kind of a wild landmark thing for television as a medium, you know, like idea of just, yo, your favorite news guy just got possessed.
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy to me in hindsight. I mean, at least partially led to the found footage Blair Witch phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of crazy to me that this isn't more well known internationally.
I mean, part of it is that, again, it was never rebroadcast in the UK, and I think still to this day has not been, but it didn't really find its way to home video until, I want to say, like, the last 15 years. For a long time, it just wasn't around. Like, you either had a VHS copy of it, and, you know, or that found its way to, like, archive.org or something, and that was kind of the only way you could really watch it. I think there's a version on YouTube, too. But, yeah, in the there's a DVD release, and they just did a 30th anniversary Blu-ray release of this for the first time. And I think the last decade, people have really kind of caught on to it.
Mm.
I bet watching this before it was released officially, like watching a like second generation dubbed VHS tape of this would make it even better.
Totally. Like a thing you're not supposed to be watching.
Yeah, and like, you know, lots of bad analog video distortion stuff.
Brad, I do have a side question. In the living room, this is a very Brad question. What computer thing is in front of the TV? Is that a
I don't know.
Pet? What is that?
I saw, what's the older girl's name? Susan?
Susie?
Suzanne?
I think.
Susie? They call her Susie, yeah. Like, I don't know. I wondered about that. I mean, Britain definitely had, like, their own old computer scene that was not entirely the same as...
There are a bunch of Commodore stuff bouncing around, right?
Yeah, I don't know what that was.
Okay.
I actually don't know.
Okay. All right, I had to ask.
There's like Acorn, I think, is another one from the era.
Somebody in our comments will know what the heck that thing is.
Yeah, somebody absolutely will know what that was.
They had one. But yeah, I liked from when the wet spot goes, and they go, what is it? Now taste the hanky. Smell the hanky.
Smell it.
I know, smell the hanky was definitely
smell the hanky. That and the glory hole were maybe the parts that were like, okay. All right, now I can see why people got upset about this.
Well, let's talk about what the glory hole is, because I feel like we've kind of talked about it in little bits here, but it is kind of a central thing in all of this. It's a, I don't know how to describe it. It's not like a basement entrance, but I've seen these kinds of things in like colonial houses.
Yeah.
So it's usually under the steps kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's the space under the stairs. There's like not a full height, but there is a door that you can open to get in there. I assume it must be pretty British because that's also kind of a big deal in Harry Potter. That's where he lives. Like the evil aunt and uncle make him live in whatever that space is.
The
under
glory
the stairs.
Hole.
So,
well, there's also that movie, The People Under the Stairs. Yes.
Yes. So I wonder if it's like a very pretty common thing in British homes, maybe.
I remember seeing a few of those in Virginia and in Massachusetts in some of the older colonial homes, but I can't say I've ever seen one in like a modern house. But, you know, it's a storage space. You know, it's an area to just sort of like throw stuff under if you don't have like an attic or a basement. But in this case, in this house, it has been boarded up because of whatever presence is in there. And we should talk about the presence itself, which is alluded to as pipes. Is what the kids have started calling this ghost.
That's like kind of a creepy name for a ghost.
Yeah.
Totally.
I thought.
And the reason they call it pipes is because it likes to knock on the plumbing in the house to let you know it's there. And they kind of muddle this a little bit in the narrative because they're kind of talking about multiple hauntings here and multiple figures. But the parapsychologist kind of puts a stamp on it toward the end when she's sort of describing what this entity actually is. Which is to say, it is a combination, a larger swirling mass of negative energies from various figures that have lived in this area and maybe even in this house.
I think this is the onion skin.
What is?
I mean, what happened on that spot? How many terrible things have...
Oh, this has got to be nonsense, Doctor.
Before Tunstall, before Mother Seddon's, way back, maybe into prehistory.
Oh, nonsense. I mean, no more calls, please. Also, our switchboard's jammed. We've been inundated with hoaxes.
The Rosenheim poltergeist affected a telephone exchange, rang
there.
Up endless bills, misdirected calls.
Poltergeist or no poltergeist.
They're seeing it now, for God's sake. Don't close the lines. We need to know what's happening out there.
You're the expert. What is happening out there?
I don't know.
And they specifically allude to two figures... An old baby farmer, which I'm glad we don't use that nomenclature anymore, who was killing children around the turn of the century. And then also this mentally disturbed individual who had been in a psychiatric hospital, who was living there with his family. his aunt and uncle, I guess, and killed himself in the glory hole at some point, which is where they talk about the cats eating his face after he was dead and all that kind of stuff.
12 days, Alex.
12 days he was in there before they found his body.
They got hungry.
They got hungry.
You know what happened.
And so when they eventually getting around to kind of explaining what the actual entity is, it's not one person. It's supposed to be this giant evil mass that has sort of taken the form of these people who have been affected by it over the years. It's not really much of anything other than a larger explanation for why something so evil and so powerful would be in this random council house. But it's fine. It gets you there. I mean, the backstory for it is very cheesy ghost story shit.
Yeah. So there were, yeah, like you said, I mean, there were multiple explanations. Did they kind of settle on, like, all of them combined caused this? Like, I feel like somebody says toward the end something along the lines of just, like, a lot of evil things have happened here or something like that.
Yeah. Because you get the phone calls from various people explaining their history with the house or what they know about it and some of these backstories. But it's the parapsychologist who at some point says, there is evil here, and it's not just these people.
Right. And it's not just the guy from the 60s who killed himself, right?
Yeah, or the baby farmers. That's something maybe older and more ancient. Yeah. Look, if there's one thing I know about Europe, it's that ancient evil is just all over that goddamn place.
I mean, actually, there was like a much more mundane example was it the news reporter describing her vision of the Indian concubine?
But it wasn't scary.
Well, in the moment we've got here now, Sarah, perhaps you could tell us that ghost story you told us about earlier on.
Oh, yes, all right. Well, I suppose it's a sort of ghost story. It happened a couple of months ago now. We were staying at some friends of ours' home. They live in the Cotswolds, beautiful 15th, 16th century house. And one night, I was woken up by the sound of this harpsichord music. It was like chamber music. But you know when a noise comes into your dream and you're not quite sure it's in a dream or whether it's actually happening? It was that kind of effect. But it woke me up nonetheless. And when I tried to get back to sleep again, I could still hear it. But all I could see was this Indian woman's face. And she had her hair sort of pulled across her forehead and then tightly back, and kohl around her eyes. And her eyes were going from side to side, you know, like in Indian dancing. And slowly the eyes lifted up and rolled right back until they were white, and then the face went. Well, next morning, I couldn't wait to sort of tell everybody about this. And the people whose house it is, they told me that the house had once belonged to the Viceroy of India, and he had had two Indian concubines living in the house with him. And when they died, he couldn't bury them in consecrated ground. He wasn't allowed to. So he buried them out in his garden. And there had been talk in the village of actually digging up the grave to see what else was down there. And it became very clear to me that this was a sort of message to say, no, don't, they mustn't do it. And so when I found out that they weren't in fact planning to do anything with the grave, they wouldn't dream of it, I went back up to the bedroom and I just sort of said, don't worry, nothing's going to happen. And it was as though the atmosphere changed straight away. I have to say, Smithy was a bit scared the next night. He wouldn't admit it, but he was. But nothing happened. And it was as though everything had gone calm again. But the important thing here, it wasn't scary at all. I mean, the music and the vision was very beautiful. But that's why I wanted to do this program, because it's intriguing.
The part that stuck out to me was that she very just casually mentioned, like, oh, I was staying overnight in this beautiful, you know, 15th, 16th century home, you know. Yeah. God, that's like so foreign and inexperienced to Americans to have houses that are...
Look. I was
600 years old.
Saying this to my wife yesterday after we watched this, and I was like, Europe's got a lot of really old, messed up sins. We are, at the very least, our silver lining is when we stole this land from the native peoples, they were very in touch with their environment and had at least it sounds like a good relationship with the spirits and not a horrible one with the spirits. So when we took over that land by force, we just have the years on top of that where we did all of our sins. But Europe's got thousands of years of horrible things going on.
Yeah, yeah, if there's one thing I know about Europe, it's that no one there has a good relationship to the land.
Right.
You know, there's that adage about in Europe, 100 miles is a long distance. In America, 100 years is a long time.
Right, okay.
Mm-hmm. You know, so like they've just got the idea of centuries or even millennia old structures in history feels in the imagination, it's a lot easier to imbue that with some ancient evil.
Some really old sins. Yes.
Yes.
When I was in the UK, one of the two times I went to what is, I guess, considered the oldest pub in all of the United Kingdom, and it is from the 1200s.
Yes. I think my uncle went to that same one and told me, is the ceiling also quite low there?
Ceiling's very low, and it's built into the into a rock wall. Like, okay, there's it's like on the side of like a rocky kind of outcropping behind the building.
I'm sure it's a big tourist destination if it's officially like the oldest one, but yeah.
But yeah, like it's things there are impossibly old. And I will say, the other thing I was just going to mention real quick. So that ghost story that Sarah Green tells, that's real. Like that's her story.
She
ad-libbed that. Like they asked her to just on the fly, be like, hey, tell us a ghost story. And so that is her personal ghost story. Whether you believe it or not, I'm not here to tell you if it's real or not. I'm just saying that was something that she says happened to her.
Would I believe that they're going to disturb the graves of sure, yes.
Of Indian concubines? Absolutely.
I had nothing happened, so she says.
From here, we talked a little bit about kind of the setup and the buildup to kind of where things pop off. But once they do, there's two branches. There's the it's a hoax branch, and then there's the oh, actually, this shit is real branch.
Mm-hmm.
The hoax branch, there's some stuff that happens in that time. There's the children's drawings, as I mentioned, that are sort of scattered across the floor. There's banging, some of which could just be the kid that's doing it, or it could be, other stuff. There's the cats, which are sort of inexplicable, like the kid can't fake the cats and the cat noises. Then there's obviously the visions that we see in the little reflections here and there. But then, there's the hard turn. Like, the kid is missing from the bed. They don't know where she went. They find her in a closet banging on the pipes.
Pictures are falling off the walls.
Yeah. And so she, freaks out because she thinks she's been caught, or at least that's what we're led to believe. But the mother is unmoved. She's like, yeah, look, the parapsychologist has been here. She's seen what's happened here. My daughter is not doing all of this.
Yeah, they kind of save it pretty effectively.
Yeah.
Like you kind of, and then even the little girl has like the breakdown of just like, I was just trying to show them what they want to see.
Right.
This
is like what you wanted. Kinda,
they make it believable enough.
But this is what you wanted, I feel like, is less the refrain of this daughter and maybe more the refrain of the Force. I think, obviously the idea here is, which they eventually get to, is the idea that this special has been turned into a mass seance unknowingly.
I thought that was a kind of cool concept.
Yeah.
That was interesting. You've created, I can't ever stop thinking about things in computing terms, but it's almost like you've networked a seance, This is like distributed summoning process or protocol.
It's in the machine.
What?
Well, look at the picture.
Where?
On the wall. The picture on the wall.
What about the picture on the wall?
It's still there. It hasn't fallen. It's not come off the wall. This picture we're seeing now isn't live. This is some earlier footage from earlier in the evening. This is just a cover. It's a dupe.
But
this isn't happening now.
But what is happening? There's a wind in the studio. Have you ever heard of a wind in it? Turn on the studio.
What service do we have
to know? I don't understand.
Jesus, Michael, we've created a seance. A massive seance.
And that is definitely a thing that later found footage stuff, especially things that kind of dabble in like internet ghosts, have played around with a lot.
Sure.
But, it's a novel concept here. But the thing you get, and the impression that I get, is that as much as the daughter may be acting out a little bit in the sense of, like, she's, psychologically traumatized and is sort of, like, trying to make sure that, the experiences that she's had are not left unaware to the people that are there to document it. There's also, like, potentially a degree of possession happening here, because we see it later on with the daughter when she's huddled in the corner and starts talking in that voice.
And there's also a little bit of confusion or misdirection or whatever you want to call it about which daughter is the conduit for the spirit and like
yeah.
who's the who's going to be the kind of the one who's really in touch with the spirit? Is it the older sister? Is it the younger sister? Is it both of them in tandem?
Yeah, and I think the thing they kind of land on is that the spirit might be using them for different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the younger daughter for like communication, and it's the older daughter for acts of violence and kinetic, you know, energy.
And then you get the scratched up kid. That mm-hmm. was pretty rough.
Like a lot happens very quickly.
Don't touch me. And then there's like a, yeah, right. Then there's just a frenzy of camera like people running around. And
like, it's a good way to follow up the hoax stuff. You know, like they get it back on track, like very effective. Like the pictures scattered everywhere, the water spots, the scratches, the voice.
Yeah.
Probably other stuff. I'm looking through it right now.
When do we get the bunny in the sink? That's towards even the end, right?
That's towards the end.
Okay.
Even like the video breaking up and just like distortion in the video equipment failure stuff.
The video distortion effects and the audio distortion effects, I'm going to say, are probably the cheesiest actual things they do here. It's very like, I mean, whatever their equivalent of Final Cut Pro would have been back then. You know, like these are the stock effects for this stuff. But, you know, it again, they're working on a TV budget in 1992. I'm not expecting the world here.
Yeah. I thought like one of the creepier ideas, I think you touched on it, was the idea of the ghost taking control of electronics.
Yes.
Specifically, it's like, I mean, everybody sees the head injury, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to find it. Like, the people in the studio see that, don't they?
Yeah, I think
they
that's
do.
The last thing they... No, right. Last thing
it's
they
one of the
see
last things
real?
They see before the weird cut.
Yeah.
I feel like they kind of just let that go, because the second that the, like, idyllic shot of them playing a board game in the living room pops up, they're like, oh, see, everything's fine there. They're in... Things must be normal. It's like, did you not see the guy's head bashed? Like, you seem very quick to accept that everything is fine there now.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was pretty, you know, a decent bit of writing where, okay, the reason we can't hear anything is because the sound guy is gone.
Is out.
Is
yeah.
out. And so we just have this visual from the other camera. Of
yeah,
the
but it's sorry. Like, it's like maybe 2 minutes from the shot of the guy's head bleeding to the board game footage. I just
yeah.
thought that was like one of the creepiest moments to me, was the idea that the ghost was showing them fake footage and that something actually awful was
yeah.
happening
yes.
behind this front.
Yeah, like, they get at some really interesting ideas with that stuff. And again, they're limited kind of what they can do with the time span and budget that they have. But like, as a concept, I think that's actually pretty radical for the early 90s. And, you know, yes, if an actual journalist were there on site and started seeing that footage, I think they would probably be able to correctly identify the fact that that's the exact same footage they saw earlier in the night. But in the hectic sort of throes of, you know, the crazed phone calls they're getting from people, Mike Smith getting more and more agitated about what's going on with his wife and, you know, sort of not really understanding any of what they're watching, especially post hoax reveal. I kind of get that, like, okay, look, whatever, it's fine. Everything's fine, right? But they don't linger on that for very long, because the parapsychologist within a few minutes is like, wait a minute, no, that's not possible. That can't be the footage.
Right, the picture's still on the wall.
Remember the picture falling down? Like, that's the thing that somehow they seize on, and not the fact that it's literally identical footage from what they saw earlier.
And then it gets a little weird. Then it's kind of all over the place, right? Because then it's like, they cut to the on location, the comedian guy, and there's just like,
he's freaking out.
Is he? Well, there's a part where he's like, not sure if he's on their live or not, and he's talking, and then like, it seems a little disjointed at that point. Then you get some scenes of people getting wheeled out of the house, the guy with the head injury getting wheeled out, and,
yeah, like they lead the family out.
Yeah,
I mean, I think the like man on the street guy breaking character at all is kind of like freaking out for him.
Yeah,
you know, like the fact that he's kind of dropped his act. This is kind of the tell there, that even he thinks something bad is going on.
Well, like the fact that he looks genuinely concerned, the part where the cops roll up. I will say the only person who is maybe not giving a convincing performance here is one of the late is the lady cop, who is like smiling as she walks up to the house.
Yeah.
I
mean, there's a little bit of a fundamental tension in this the whole time, around the fact that there is this giant media circus right outside the house.
Yes.
And that like, whatever awful stuff is going on in there at any given moment, you could just run in there and grab them and pull them out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like at a certain point, it feels a little bit contrived that like, oh, they're stuck in there and awful things are happening. I mean, I guess they do actually lead the family out eventually, you know?
Yeah.
But like the stakes feel like they are portrayed as very high when there's a pretty obvious solution for getting them out of the danger.
But there's also there like a self-inflicted wound here where I think is it Sarah, right? Like keeps on going. Like she wants to.
Yeah.
And I mean, look, there's the age old horror trope of, you know, the people are trapped in the house and they can't open the doors and they don't know why kind of stuff. They don't really show that or do that here, but you could probably fill in the blanks with some like, hey, we tried to beat the door down. We couldn't, you know, when they show the family coming out, it's just the mom and the younger daughter.
Yeah.
And the older one is still missing. And the mother tries to go back in and they pull her back and are like, no, don't go in there. And then you cut to the infrared footage, which is just creepy as fuck. Like, even though they don't really show anything with the infrared, like they don't show like a fake person standing behind or anything. You're waiting for it. And it just the vibe of it is very creepy.
I was shocked they never did some kind of trick or reveal or jump scare thing with the infrared.
I honestly think they may not have known how to do that effectively with that technology being as nascent as it was back then.
Yeah, I mean, the restraint is impressive if it was intentional, you know.
Yeah.
To not do the obvious thing there.
But, you know, then we get the end of Sarah and the total fucking breakdown of everything. You know, she hears the older daughter's voice coming from the glory hole. Hopefully it's the last time I have to say that on this podcast. And opens it and like hears her voice coming from it, and she starts to walk in, and the camera guy's like, "No, what are you doing? What are you doing?" And the door slams shut on her.
Sarah? Sarah?
Please. It's okay, Susie. We're here.
In the studio!
Where are you?
In the glory.
It's all right.
Yeah.
Come on, baby. Get away. It's all right, Susie. Susie?
I can't open the door. It's blocked.
Susie! You've got to try and push the door open from the inside. Come on. Get off me!
Yeah, she gets like sucked in there.
Yeah,
kinda. Like I kind of got the sense that she's like under the spell at that point.
Yeah,
right. Like she feels, or it feels like she's very entranced and wants to go in there. It's not like she's not frightened at all.
Yeah, she's like, oh, it's you.
Yeah, the way the door slams is like kind of. I don't know if they sped that up.
Yeah,
or something.
Or like
the way the door slams is extremely crisp.
It's like, unnatural.
It almost looks like they sped that part of the footage up or something because it. It does not look like a normal slam.
Yeah.
So is that the ghost in the rafters of the studio directly after that?
I think yes, it is. The one that's like where this light is exploding. Yes, I believe the ghost is standing up there.
Yeah, I was torn on the fact that the ghost like breaks containment in this. Mm-hmm. I think I think the mass seance idea is extremely clever for sure to explain that. I also think just like. It's a clever way of writing themselves out of like the bind they put themselves in, you know, which is that like everything is just happening in that house, right? Like,
right.
You have to do something at the end once things inevitably go wrong in the house to tie up what's going on in the outside. And you can't just have everybody in the studio sitting there like slack jawed at what just happened and then cut to black, you know, like you've got to do something to tie things up on the outside. But I did not expect them to go all the way to like. Coffee mugs flying off tables and lights exploding.
Totally. And I mean, look, you get some of that with the phone calls where people are calling in to say, like, I've been watching your special and my fucking glass coffee table broke. You know, like this other thing went flying across the room. I saw a figure in the room, like
my
stuff like that.
Sandwich.
The idea that if you are watching this special, you are now susceptible to this haunting is a really great concept. And the way they deliver on it, again, is very TV and very stagey, but like, I love this visual of this very seemingly unflappable British TV presenter. Just like the cameras wheeling by him. Yeah. There's wind he can't explain.
I think it's the wind is the thing that really gets me. It's
like, we've never had wind in the studio.
It's really the end of days in there.
Yeah. The lights go out and then he comes back up and no one's there. And is it believable? Not particularly, but is it effective? The shot of him with the static camera not really framed on him and him just wandering around being like, well, the lights have come back up and
There's no one around, and I don't know which are the cameras on? Are we able to talk to this? What's going on? And then suddenly the demon voice starts coming through.
Studio's completely dark. Just blackness now. All the lights are filled. The power's gone off. We've got some lights in the studio. I don't know. There's cameras, but I don't know which one's working. I mean, there are no cameramen. I mean, it's difficult to know, even if anybody's still with us. But if they are, this is the scene in this studio, this totally deserted studio. Auto cue's working. Round and round the garden, like a teddy bear.
I've always been a fan of the kind of camera on its side mayhem happening. It was a thing we used in the Giant Bomb Game of the Year thing. Remember with the studio gets with the footage, and then the camera's on its side, and everybody's running around doing like what is going on? I always feel like that's very effective. Like, you're not supposed to see this. This is the whole presentation is broken. This is real true mayhem, and they do a great job here with him just always off frame or out of frame, kind of wandering around because he's so staid the entire time. He's so in control.
Yeah. And even when he starts getting flustered toward the end, it's not like he's screaming his head off or fucking freaking out. It's very much just like what do you think it is then? What do you think? What is happening?
You're
the expert.
He kind of goes into like newsman mode here at the end of like everything has completely gone to shit, but he's still describing what he's seeing.
Yes.
You know? It's like kind of like TV photojournalist type people like never stop reporting.
It's very like captain of the ship.
Yes. And also just very, I have to document this, like very... Nothing is more important than describing what is going on here, no matter how bad it is.
The cats.
And honestly, like, I think it's great. Like, I love the I think the casting choice is perfect for this stuff. These presenters in particular are so game for what they are trying to do that I feel sort of bad that they caught shit after the fact because of the fact that it is this, you know, look, it's a thing that was presented. Even though it was not presented as real, saying this is a true thing that is happening, it is presented in the style of a thing that is real, and that was enough to set people off and freak them out to such a degree that, like, they had to answer questions about this thing for basically the rest of their life.
I absolutely would not have shown this to my kids. Like, I was, you know, this is one of those things, too, that I feel like we are so cynical and jaded we can immediately spot this as a send up, but like
I was completely, I thought you were saying you would not have shown it to them because you didn't want to scare them.
I also mean, like, when I was watching it with my wife, I was like, this would freak my kids out. Like this.
Then I've double misunderstood. I thought I thought you were saying you wouldn't have shown it to them because they would have seen right through it and just laughed at it or something.
No. They you know, I have watched enough stuff with my kids that, you know, we have enough experience to know when somebody's pulling your leg or the cynicism, but like there's still a bit of sincerity there left in my children where I think they would be like, this is fake, right? This is fake. And be like, yes, this is fake. And like something would ping pong in there, Pac-Man in their brain.
Yeah.
You know, when we went to bed, that would freak them out.
I'll say it again. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Brad.
No, I knew the whole thing was fake. I still turned on a couple extra lights before I went to bed.
Totally. Like, I heard knocks in my attic the night after the night I watched this, and whatever, it's just an old house. It makes creaky sounds, but I'm not going to sit here and say I didn't clench a little bit when I heard them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the thing I realized, and I think it took me my entire life until I saw this to really realize it, is because of the contrast between this and reality is so stark. Like, it's extremely obvious this is a put on, right? You know, to people our age or whatever. It's less, the point I'm making is like the thing itself didn't scare the shit out of me. It's more what it makes you imagine, you know, like walking away from it. Like, it's not that I was afraid of pipes or whatever, but it was more just the idea of a presence behind you in a really vague, abstract sense is just like so terrifying to the lizard brain.
And when I was 17, I think, is when The Blair Witch came out in 1999, I believe, if I remember correctly. And, you know, at 17 years old, I was about as jaded and cynical as you could possibly get. And I still came away from that thing genuinely unnerved in a way where I did not sleep well for at least a night or two after the fact. And, I spent the next day doing a lot of online research to make sure that what I saw was definitely not real. Because even the possibility that it could be was enough to kind of freak me out.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, the last shot of that movie is like an all-time effective, terrifying ending.
Absolutely. It's still one of the most iconic horror images there is, especially in American cinema.
It was good. This was good.
Yeah. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it. I really did not know how you were going to respond to it, given its age and its, you know, its origins as a TV special the way that it is. I wasn't sure if it would be effective at all.
I think the way I would put it is that it's pretty effective in spite of itself,
mm-hmm.
despite its shortcomings and limitations. Like, it actually does work quite well, even with the distance of 30 years from it, you know, and all the cultural awareness that has permeated since then.
Yeah. And I'll say, like, you know, I saw this for the first time a couple of years ago, and it's the only other time I'd watched it. And, you know, I think the thing I came away the first time was just an admiration for it.
Yeah.
And what they tried to accomplish and what they were able to pull off with what they had. I think watching it a second time, I'm a little more even appreciative of the way they pace out their narrative and the way they structure things, because I think that is the trick. That is the thing that gets you into this, is their willingness to make this special kind of boring for like the first 40 minutes where not a lot is happening and they're just kind of telling you without ever showing you. I think their commitment to that is a huge factor in why the rest of it works so well.
Yeah, like, I don't know if I would have made it through the entire thing if I was just watching it for fun, and mm-hmm. not because we had to for a podcast, but because I had to stick with it, I see how that slow build is actually, it's effective at when the tension finally comes, but also it's effective at selling the illusion of, like, yeah, this is actually a live TV program that doesn't always go according to plan and might be kind of dull in spots.
And they leave enough unanswered to keep it super creepy. Like, what happened to everybody? What, you know, they don't wrap it up nicely, which is always an effective thing.
I assumed everyone figured it out by the next time Parky was on TV. You know, like, that was like, okay, yeah, he's fine. He was not actually possessed by a demon, but still.
What happened to Sarah?
I'm sure she was on fucking BBC One, like, the next day, you know? They said when it aired, they went to a little out-of-the-way restaurant, the entire cast of the thing, to watch it live because it was supposed to be a live special. So they didn't want to be seen out in the street or recognized while it was happening. And I guess while they were watching it, they were just like, oh, this is great. This is awesome. You know, like, look at how well this all came together. And then as soon as they got out and they started hearing about what the response to the thing was, they were like, oh no.
Look, it's
30,000 phone calls is not nothing in the UK.
The public is not our best litmus test for for anything, really. A general public, it's tough out there. I don't even know how to put this one on a list. It's so weird. Because it's kind of we haven't really done fake documentary stuff, but I'm just gonna stick it on the list between Trespass and Resident Evil because why not.
Yeah,
it goes on the list. I think it's below The Fold, but it is still up there. So,
hey, is this better than Virtuosity? We're here to tell you.
It is better than Is it better than Free Jack? It's higher.
Yes.
It's higher on my
Most
list.
Things are.
Jack. Yeah.
Would this have been different with cell phones? Probably not.
Would this have been different with cell phones? Yes. Everybody would have been recording from the streets. Everybody would have been live.
You would have to change the presentation in several key ways.
Maybe a little bit. I feel like the presence of cameras everywhere already, though, kind of dampens that.
It was pretty good. The cell phones would have had to not work. You would have had to have some MacGuffin for cell phone service going out.
Yeah.
Though, how much creepier would it have been if the last thing was like an image from inside the Sarah, a texting or picture from inside the glory hole. Some weird blurry image from inside.
It's
there
just her doing the selfie face, just like, "Hey guys, I'm here in the glory hole,"
with a bunch of
like and subscribe,
a bunch of hearts like flipping off as people are like, "Oh man, the glory hole, that's great." This is
#pipes.
Just like people doing pipes emojis underneath it.
Oh no, pipes would be an icon among the online youth, like within seconds.
Man, just yes, a little different with cell phones. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you guys for taking this journey with me. And this journey's not over, because October has four more Mondays in it, which means we have four more films.
That's great. That we I need love to Mondays. Peruse.
We have made the list. I have not put them in the exact order yet, but that schedule will be up already on the Patreon by the time this episode goes live, so you will have access to it. But we can, at the very least, announce what the other films in this month will be, as we have discussed it now, finally. So we're going to jet set around to some other places. We are going to take a stop in Italy with a classic giallo film in Suspiria. We are going to move out to Japan, and we're going to cover one that, Vinny, you've been talking about wanting to watch for a bit here. It was a toss-up. It was either going to be Ringu or it was going to be this, and then Ringu is not streaming anywhere in the U.S. right now, so that made me flip the coin in the other direction. We are going to watch Houseu/House.
And I had never seen it. You guys watched it without me, mostly because, again, I'm very susceptible to hauntings.
I'm going to say right now, Houseu is not a horror movie in the way that these other movies we are doing probably are, but it is a really fascinating thing and one of the wildest movies I've ever seen.
Great.
Huh.
We will then move. We are also moving over to Korea, and we are going to watch a zombie film that I have some regard for in Train to Busan, okay. A very kinetic zombie film. It is not a slow burn, shall we say.
Heard good things.
It's very good. And lastly on the list, again, this is not the final order. I'm still working that out, but it will be up on the Patreon soon. This is Brad's suggestion, a latecomer, and one I think is a good one, an Australian horror film, The Babadook.
Okay. I've not seen any of these.
Okay. Brad, you have seen The Babadook, right?
We just saw it okay. Like 2 weeks ago, randomly.
Okay.
Thought highly of it.
I have not seen it since it came out. I liked it a lot at the time. I'm looking forward to revisiting it because I have not done so since. But that movie's also very good and very fucking creepy. So that's not one to watch with the kids, Vinny. You could probably watch Houseu with the kids.
I
would maybe not watch most of these other ones with them.
I don't know. I'm the biggest kind of like scaredy cat in the house when it comes to that stuff. But we'll see.
I don't think Houseu's gonna scare you.
Okay, we'll see.
I think it's going to baffle you.
Listen, I still got a bucket in my basement I won't touch.
I don't know what that has to do with this movie.
Oh, man. You're really going to have a time with Babadook then. I forgot about the whole basement.
Because I think my basement's haunted.
Oh. Yeah.
Anyway.
Well.
Sorry, I'm just going to jump in before you send it out. I've got a little nugget here.
Mm-hmm.
A little tidbit to send us off with.
Okay.
I did the work. I took a screenshot of that computer in the living room and put it into Google image search.
Okay.
It's definitely a Commodore.
All right. Is it a PET?
It may be a PET.
VIC 20.
There were a lot of Commodores that looked almost exactly like that.
Okay.
CBM2 B128, the PET 510.
Okay.
A lot of the Commodores, the C710, a lot of them looked basically like that, so it's hard to tell.
Okay.
Definitely a non C64 Commodore though.
Okay.
Yeah, it was too big for a C64. Somebody had one. Somebody who watched this will know.
Well, this will be our last salute to the Commodore for this podcast, but that is I'm glad you figured that out because that is what people come to these podcasts for is our expert analysis on what old computer is in a thing. That's exactly. What we are all about here. And that is going to do it for this here Nextlander Watchcast. As I said, the full schedule for the month of October is probably already up by the time you are listening to this podcast. So if you are at all confused about what we were going to be watching in what order, it's there for you. So check it out. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Vinny.
Thank you, Alex.
And thank you to everyone who has been watching and listening at long at home with us. We'll see you next time.